ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
The world right now is a disaster. It's easy to feel helpless. But there was a moment when millions of people around the world said enough. I'm Sisong Kim Simong. Join me for Boycott, the fight to end apartheid, how Australians joined others around the world to push back against racism and won.
Whites only teams, we thought that to the average Australian, that would be despicable.
Boycott, the fight to end apartheid. Search for ABC Rewind on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
It was one of those calls that I think we all live in fear of. And I can tell you in explicit detail where I was, which is kind of strange because I was in a completely unfamiliar Airbnb. And yeah, I don't think you ever forget where you are when you receive one of those calls.
This is health journalist Casey Barrows.
I remember that the carpet was like flecks of, I want to say, pink and blue, and there were two single beds in this kind of guest room. And I just remember sort of standing for the first part and then sitting on the edge of the bed and then kind of slumping. And I kind of felt the blood trickle from the top of my head out through my toes is what it felt like. Aww. You know, I realized very, very quickly that this was really genuinely terrible news to be receiving.
And what was the news?
The news was that my dad had been diagnosed with a disease called mesothelioma. So for anybody who is not familiar, mesothelioma is cancer from exposure to asbestos. And being the good millennial I am, I very quickly put him on speakerphone and then had a very quick top line look at what he was looking at by way of prognosis. Now, please bear in mind that at that point I had been a health journalist for 15 years, so this is not something that I would recommend, but I was able to look very quickly and gather just a couple of really reputable sources to get a sense of what it was that he was looking at. And I will never forget my eyes just kind of darting from link to link, seeing, you know, 6 months, 8 months, 12 months, words like fatal and incurable and rapidly progressing.
This was a life-changing call for Casey. She packed up her life in Sydney and moved to Perth with her husband and kids to be closer to her dad. And she took on a completely new role within her family, carer. It's a role that more than 3 million people in Australia occupy, about 12% of the population, and it can take a major toll.
There were certainly times where I was reaching out to my family and saying, like, guys, I haven't got this. Like, I have two small children. I have a husband. I'm trying to keep some money coming in the door. I can't be with him 24/7 and I need you guys to step up. Drill Sergeant Casey was my nickname amidst my family, which, let me tell you, really ruffled my feathers when I first heard it. And then I sort of realised, like, actually, this is the reality of it. Like, somebody does need to be in charge.
Casey's experience inspired her to write a book, one that explores both her experience and her dad's.
The name of my book is Next of Kin, so it is a what to expect when you're expecting for the other end of life. You know, it is equal parts story and compassionate, practical guide. And I feel so lucky that I get to share him with the world.
This is All in the Mind from ABC Radio National. I'm Sana Qadar. Today, what it takes to be a carer for a loved one, how to get through the hardest moments and toughest conversations, and still come out the other side in one piece. How close were you and your dad?
Dad and I had always been very, very close. My parents split up when I was very, very young. And so I lived with dad half the week, mum half the week. And so I had lots of this, you know, really deep and meaningful one-on-one time with him from when I was very little. And so I think for that reason and a bunch of others, we were really, really close.
And how would you describe your dad? What kind of person was he like?
I would describe him as a free spirit. His name was Jack.
Right.
He actually changed his name about a decade before he passed away. His name was originally Dennis, and he just had never felt like that had fit him. And so he had changed his name to Jack. And to be honest, it was actually a much better name for him. It really, really suited him. You know, there were five of us to four different women, and he never married any of those, but he married a couple of others. So if I'm painting a bit of a picture,
yes.
You know, I still viscerally remember women's reaction to him when he would come and pick me up from school wearing a sarong and a t-shirt. Like, he really was a really beautiful man, 6'3" and beautiful dark skin and the most intelligent person, I still think, to this day. He was kind of the apple of my eye, aww, I think. And yeah, I just adored him.
And when you describe him like that, yeah, Dennis feels like a very straight-laced kind of name. Jack feels more appropriate.
Yeah, it does.
So to come back to that call, you get this awful news. Do you remember what you said in response?
Yes. Look, I think one of my superpowers, and whether this is just my neurodivergent nature or whatever, is I'm very, very good in a crisis, even when it kind of directly relates to me. And so I remember getting very, very calm. Mm. I remember thanking him for delivering that information to me and acknowledging how hard that must have been, and, you know, telling him that we would kind of work it out together. All of that said, he clearly had done some work to get to that point to be able to deliver that news to me. I think there was only one or two people who knew at that point. And mesothelioma is one of those sort of trickier diagnoses where it's not pretty quick to diagnose. It takes some time.
Your response towards hearing that news, that sounds like a very mature way to handle such bad news. You give some advice in the book as well about how to both deliver bad news and receive it. And part of that advice comes from directly from your dad, and part of it's from you. Can you talk about some of this advice for how to deliver bad news, and then we'll flip to receiving?
Yeah, sure. And I will just say that I'm painting a picture of myself that does sound quite mature and level-headed. Rest assured that when I hung up from that phone call, I completely fell apart. So I'm not sort of being promotive of like ultimate stoicism. I just, in those moments when there's somebody else who is having to be big and brave and deliver this incredibly difficult information to you, it felt, I don't know, respectful or kind to be able to catch, you know, this steaming hot ball of lava that he has just thrown at me in a way that doesn't cause further distress on him.
That isn't so incredible. Like, that stands out to me as maturity as well, because it just makes me think of a time in my own life when I became a carer. I was much younger when this happened. I was 22, and it was my partner who was diagnosed with cancer. But I remember when I got that call, I did none of the things that you did. I burst into tears on the phone, and I don't think it was very helpful. So it's incredible to hear how you handled that.
Look, and that's really, really kind of you to say. And I will say that that is the benefit of getting a call like that when you are 36 or 46 or 56. You know, you've got some life behind you. But I think that that actually really beautifully outlines, I guess, what my advice would be. And I will premise this by saying that, you know, our bodies will jump into fight or flight and do what they do. And I don't want anybody who's listening to this to have had an experience like the one that you just shared and feel bad. But I guess that's why conversations like these are so important, because it allows us to plant these seeds in ourselves so that when these calls come, and they're coming for all of us at some point in our lives, that we do have some tools to be able to deal with them. And I think that, you know, Dad thanked me later for being able to catch that information and not make it about the impending loss, and also to not make it about me. And so I guess from the deliverer's perspective, from in this case, Dad's perspective, one of the things that he shared with me was that he had done some work with a psychologist. He had reached out to somebody before he went and shared that news to get some tips from him. And one of the things that psychologist shared with him was, in the beginning, really keep the news very close because, and I love this term, he said there is a very ghoulish aspect of humanity where people are naturally drawn to bad news. And what that does is it sort of detracts your energy from being able to focus on yourself and navigating through this and your healing. Now, I say in the book, I think when you go through these types of things, it's not time to be private, it's time to be human. But I think that that advice is actually really powerful because I think you need to think really clearly through who you want to share it with and why, and then how you share it with them. For example, his parents, we told together. So him and I, me there for support to him, and them there for support for each other,
right?
Because they live in each other's pockets. They're in their 90s. They deserved to have that experience together. However, his other children, he told individually because they were much younger and they deserved to have their own experience of having that land on them in whatever way it did, all of which was appropriate and welcome, and their own floor to be able to ask questions of him. So I think just really thinking critically about who you're delivering it to and how you would deliver it to them. The other piece of advice that he got that I think is really powerful is don't beat around the bush. Don't use euphemisms or nice language. Don't bury the lead, as we would say in journalism. Just give it to them straight.
And then in terms of tips on how to receive bad news, you've covered some of it very helpfully already. Is there anything else that you think would be worthwhile to share?
For the receiver, you know, just bear in mind that there is a huge amount of courage that has had to take place in order to have this conversation with you. And you're well within your rights to say things like, can you hold on a second? I just want to get a pen. I just want to write this down. I'm nervous that I'm going to forget some of the details. Do you mind if I take some of the details down? And thank them explicitly for telling you. Acknowledge how difficult that must have been. And it's okay to say, do you mind if I take some time to digest this? And then can we have another conversation about it? You know, you might not feel ready to have an in-depth conversation about it at that exact point in time. You might want to go away and work out how you feel about it and then come back with a series of questions. And all of that is okay.
That is such a helpful and beautiful script.
Thank you.
Casey's father was diagnosed with cancer in June 2021, which, if you cast your mind back, you'll remember that was a time when interstate borders were closing unpredictably, especially in Western Australia.
We landed in Perth at midday to a press conference saying that at midnight that night, so 12 hours later, they were shutting the borders behind us indefinitely.
Wow.
So we had inadvertently moved back to Perth.
Yeah, that is such a quick and stark flip over to carer mode.
Yeah, but although I will just say, you know, he didn't really need that much quote-unquote care in the beginning. Really, it was about being a second set of eyes and ears.
Right.
And we were told that he would have 6 to 12 months, and we were so lucky we got 2.5 years with Dad, you know, really extended the amount of time that I was able to have with him. And probably the last 6 months of that were when things really stepped up from a care perspective.
Yeah, I was going to ask, because a moment ago you said you didn't really realize that you were stepping into this carer role specifically until much later. At what point were you kind of really in the thick of it and realizing, okay, I am the carer?
I reckon I realized that maybe sort of 18 months into away from his diagnosis, just when things started escalating a little bit, it started to become really apparent that I was in charge. And it's not a great realization when you realize that it's up to you to coordinate a lot of this stuff. One of the things about terminal illness is that, or in my experience anyway, is that I could ask four doctors for his sort of prognosis. Help me prepare myself and my family. What is your best estimate here? Are we talking months? Are we talking weeks? Are we talking days? And you would get four completely different answers.
God.
Like, it really struck me in that time that they have no idea. And I think that that is not at all about their level of expertise. It's about the human spirit. And the human spirit can rally like you would not believe. I can't tell you how many times we were told it's weeks now.
Oh, wow.
And then he'd live months.
Wow.
I think when you're in the position of being somebody's primary carer, maybe it's for your partner or for a parent or whatever, when you hear they've got weeks, you go, okay, these are going to be some of the roughest weeks of my life, and evidently theirs, but I can do anything for mm-hmm. a few weeks. And so you are probably, especially if you are in that sandwich generation, have small children, aging parents, you're probably already white-knuckling yeah. through. Mm-hmm. And then when it goes on for months, and then more months, and then more months, you're so exhausted, but so grateful that they're still here. It is the strangest feeling.
You're listening to All in the Mind from ABC Radio National. I'm Sana Qadar. I'm talking today to health journalist and author of Next of Kin, What to Expect When You're Expecting to Care for Someone You Love, Casey Barrows. And luckily for Casey, her friends and family were able to rally around her and help support her while she cared for her dad.
My husband and I had open dialogue. My mum was being incredibly helpful. I let the teachers at my children's school know what was going on so that they could form
right.
another layer of protection around my children. If none of those people, your boss at work, your dearest friends, you know, if those people don't know what's going on for you, then they can't support you.
And in terms of advice, there is one thing she suggests or strongly advises you don't say to someone who's going through a difficult time like she was.
And it is, let me know if there's anything I can do.
Mm, right.
Because they don't know what their name is or what day it is. You know, when you're really in the trenches, you've got no idea what they can do for you. You've given them another job to you.
Yeah.
Please, you think about what I could do for you, and then you need to come to me and tell me what that thing is.
Yeah.
They're just, you know, then I can't tell you the number of people that said that to me, but I can tell you how many of them I circled back to and said, actually, I've thought of something and here's what it is, because that number is zero.
Yeah,
I'm never, ever circling back. So don't make them do it either.
It also feels like a bit of a platitude. Like, I know when I've had that said to me, in my head I've thought, are you just being nice and saying something because you have to say something, but you don't really mean it, and that's why you've given me such a vague example of what you can do?
Yes. And so, for example, one of my friends, rather than saying, hey, I'd like to gift you a massage, here is a voucher, or you organize it and I'll pay for it. If that somebody had said that to me, I'd be like, that is so kind. Thank you so much. I'm never, ever doing that, because a massage feels way too luxurious for my current situation.
Right.
But B, there's three steps that I have to go through. I have to find the place. I have to mm-hmm. look it up. I have to look at my diary. I have to find a time. Then I have to actually contact them to book it in. And then I have to go, which sounds like a giant first world moan. But I suppose what my friend did that was so beautiful was this. She messaged me and said, I'm booking you a massage. It's on me. This place, named X, around the corner from your house, has a spot on Tuesday at 10 or Thursday at 6. I will come and look after your children. So give them like really solid, concrete options as to what would be genuinely helpful.
One of the things I did want to ask, because obviously being a carer is emotionally difficult, but it's deeply meaningful, as you've touched on. Mm-hmm. But there are also times where it's not necessarily meaningful. It's really difficult. Mm-hmm. And the person you're caring for isn't being the easiest because they're going through a lot of stuff, obviously, themselves. I wanted to ask about that, because when the person you are supporting is being difficult, perhaps being a jerk, it can be very difficult as a carer to know how to deal with that, because the normal rules of engagement are sort of out the window. Can you talk about that at all? Were there times where your father was being a bit difficult and you had to kind of deal with it?
No, Sana, it was just all roses, like absolute perfection, you know. I wish. Of course, you know, he's only human. There were absolutely times where he was not his best self, many of them, and for me too. You're exhausted and you're stressed and you're worried, and like these are the highest stakes that there are, right?
Yeah.
So we were not always our best selves. And I guess what I would say is, I think our first port of call needs to be compassion for them, but also compassion for ourselves. I think there can be a tendency in this relationship between patient and carer that patient trumps carer because patient is the one going through the thing.
Yep.
And I don't think that that's fair, actually. Mm. I think the same rules of combat apply. You know, we'll always give somebody that we love a bit of a longer leash when they're going through something.
Yeah.
Perhaps they've been made redundant, or they've had a hard day at school, or they're feeling anxious or depressed. Like, we'll often be quite kind, additionally kind to the people who are going through those things.
Yep.
And then there will come a point where you're like, do you know what? You are allowed to go through this experience. And I actually said this to Dad at one point. You know, you are allowed to go through this experience and experience it with your full humanity. And I don't for a second pretend to know what it feels like to be staring down my mortality. But you don't get to inflict damage on me in the process.
You said
because,
that.
Yeah, because, you know, I think that there can be a lot of collateral damage from these experiences, particularly for carers. And I don't think that that's fair. And I had a conversation with a few psychologists about this. I think you're allowed to say, hey, I can see that you're really struggling here, but you don't get to speak to me like that or behave towards me like that because you're doing damage to me in this process and I'm here purely to support you. So, you know, we had a couple of those conversations and they always, even if they weren't immediately received, he always circled back and said, I know, I was being difficult. I'm really sorry.
For a time, Casey's father was considering voluntary assisted dying. It was a choice that sent her on a roller coaster of emotions.
So Dad signed up successfully for voluntary assisted dying. And I remember at the time when he told me that it was something that he was interested in, I remember feeling really heartened by the fact that he had this like exit card in his pocket. I believe for him, there was a level of fear around mesothelioma. Breathing towards the end becomes really difficult. And I can only imagine how much fear that put in him. And I remember him going through the process and getting that all in place. And then when you are ready, so when you are kind of nearing the point where you would like to use it, the voluntary assisted dying team comes over to your house with these two, in our case, they were kind of two red, they look like toolboxes that you would pick up at Bunnings.
Wow, okay.
And they come over with these two boxes. And in these boxes are a dummy kit of the voluntary assisted dying substance and the real thing. And you essentially go through a rehearsal of what you would go through on the day. And the reason that they do that is because the person who is taking the substance has to be able to mix it themselves and then consume the liquid. And towards the end of people's lives, they can tend to lose their swallow reflex. And so they have to check that you're still capable of consuming that amount of liquid. And I just remember them coming over and us going through that experience and watching my dad use the dummy kit. It is the strangest rehearsal of all time, watching him pretend that this is the substance that is going to end his life. Mm-hmm. And I remember after they left, Dad passed the test. They left the real kit with us. But I remember after that thinking, you know, what I'm describing there is what's called self-administered. So you are going to take the medication yourself at any time of your choosing. But the other option is sort of physician-assisted, so that you can have a doctor usually come over and administer the medication by way of an injection. So it doesn't really matter if your swallow reflex is gone. But what a lot of people don't realize is that you kind of have to choose your pathway in that process. And so what he had signed up for was self-administered. But towards the end of that process, I was really nervous that his choice was being taken away from him. I was noticing that when he would have a sip of water, it would make him cough. And I would think to myself, well, it's one thing for it to happen with water. What if it's happening with the substance that is designed to end your life? Mm-hmm. What if you have a coughing fit and you only consume a quarter of it or a third of it? Like, what happens then?
Yeah.
And so I, you know, and they were some of the hardest conversations that I have ever had to have, was saying to him, Dad, I'm nervous that you're not going to get what you want here. And you've communicated to me really clearly that you want to go out, to use his words, with your full faculties. You want to be awake. You want it to be an active choice. And so we kind of had to go back through part of the process in order to switch to practitioner administered. And then, as the universe does, it sort of took it into its own hands. And we didn't end up using the voluntary assisted dying medication. We didn't do that. And I'm so glad now that we didn't. I know plenty of people who've had a really beautiful experience with that. But for me, having a day and time in my diary at which my dad was going to die, that felt so anxiety-inducing to me. And I would never say that to him because I was like, you get what you want.
Yeah.
You're the one doing the dying, and I'll keep all of those fears to myself. And I'm so glad that for us it didn't play out like that. And it happened at a time that wasn't chosen by us and a doctor's schedule. It just happened when it happened.
Casey's father died in November 2023. One question I'm wondering, this might be slightly odd, but I'm wondering, because you had such a long period of this kind of anticipatory, preemptive grief, when he did die, do you feel like the quality of your grief changed at all in the aftermath? Like, or just, you know, it's a different version of complicated. Like, can you quantify that at all?
That's a really good question. What I realised, or what I noticed, was bearing in mind that when you're somebody's primary carer, a huge proportion of your time is taken up in caring for them. And so one of the things that I noticed is how much time came back into my life. And I don't know whether that was for better or for worse. You know, it probably left me to my own devices a little bit too much and really created space for that grief. I remember distinctly saying in the first 6 months after he passed away, when people would ask me how I was doing, I would say I was doing really well. And I really felt like I was doing really well. I felt like I had done a lot of the work to get myself to that point. And I suppose that's the silver lining of having time, is that you have time to coach yourself through it. And then I remember about 6 months in, I had sort of stopped being able to do really rudimentary things. Like, I would still get up and get my kids to school, albeit, you know, usually on the bell or after it. I was still doing the things, but I wasn't doing any of them well. And I would really struggle to remember to take medication, to dress myself. I remember would stand in my wardrobe and just stare at my clothes going like, I actually don't know. There's too many elements here. Like, I don't understand what the weather is. I don't understand what I'm doing because I haven't looked at my diary. This is too hard for me. And I remember thinking to myself, I think something's wrong with me. I think I might be depressed. Maybe I've got a brain tumor. You know, brain tumors can change people's personalities. I was like, maybe I'm deficient in something. I need some therapy. Like, I was hunting for these reasons. And I remember standing in my wardrobe in my underwear, yet again, staring at my clothes and realizing that what I was experiencing was grief. And it hit me in the face like a sad, wet fish. And I remember thinking, oh my God, you idiot. Like, you do this for a living. You've had been a health journalist for 20 years. You've interviewed plenty of psychologists about grief. Like, you idiot. How could you have not put those two things together? But once I had that, I was like, oh my God, I'm grieving. That's what this is. Okay, I probably don't have a brain tumor. I think everything's going to be okay because I'm grieving. And so I guess what I learned is that, you know, grief doesn't follow anybody's rules or anybody's time frame. It does what it does, and we are simply along for the ride. And I say in the book, fresh grief can make you cry in the supermarket on a Tuesday, and so can 25-year-old grief. Like, it just rises up and hits you out of nowhere, and all of that is okay.
Yeah.
And so I've learned to surf the waves, so to speak.
That is health journalist and author Casey Barrows. Thanks to producer Rose Kerr, senior producer James Bullen, and sound engineer Roy Huberman. I'm Sana Qadar. Thanks for listening to All in the Mind. If you like what you're hearing, feel free to leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. That really helps people find the podcasts. And if you have any feedback, you can also contact us on allinthemind@abc.net.au. We read everything that comes through that inbox, although we don't always have time to respond to everything. There's just too few of us and too many of you, but we read everything. So if you have a message, we will definitely see it. All right. Thanks again for listening. I'll catch you next week.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.